somebody of my, shall we say, experience, if not age, you know, coming and telling a bunch of young people, you know, don't always try to tell stories with words. In fact, think about, you know, what would you do if you didn't have words to tell that story? What, you know, go through that exercise. But I do like the, you know, I like to encourage people to think beyond words, to think about, you know, can you tell a story in a series of photos? Can you build a story around a series of Instagram posts? You know, even better, can you throw it all together and really create a great, you know, immersive experience where you've got words and photos and videos and tweets and all of that stuff coming together to be the best representation of you know, the event or the subject that you're trying to create. So, you know, I don't expect people to be truly jack of all trades. I do believe that there are certain things that people are better at than others. I think that creating a video, for instance, creating really compelling, sharp, well-made, well-produced video is a skill that not everybody can master. I don't think I can master it. I think photography is a, you know, is a very specialized skill that not everyone is going to be good at. By the same token, if I've got a reporter who's covering an event and has got an iPhone, I expect that person to be able to use it and to record images, good images, and good video that we can later use and produce. So it, yes, multiple skills, jack of all trades, maybe not, if that makes sense.
Let's talk about video a little bit, actually. This is something news organizations everywhere are trying to use more and more, trying to build out. It's something your site uses effectively. It's something we see all over YouTube. And I think we can all agree the right piece of video can be enormously powerful.
Right.
I'm going to plug my own newspaper again, but if anybody saw the video we had from the day of the Ottawa shootings and the way that connected with people and the way that brought things to life for people, that shows us video can't be ignored. It's also not an easy thing for any news organization, I think even a digital news organization like yours, to do well. Tell me about the struggles you've had with video or the hurdles you're trying to get over in doing video well.
Yeah. Video is incredibly important, both from the standpoint of the way it can communicate to people. I think the way that younger audiences will be consuming, you know, content, both, you know, now and in the future, will be much more around video. That plus the fact that right now, you know, as you know, the advertising market is you know, really does value video content. And so for publishers, you have to pay attention. You have to think about, well, you know, what can you do to take advantage both of that opportunity in terms of your business model, but also in terms of reaching audiences who are, you know, consuming much, you know, all of their information or much of their information on their phones. And it's one that I'm still trying to find the right answer to, because I think that a lot of the, you know, the conventional ways of thinking about news video, whether it's practiced by, you know, some of the mainstream news networks or CNN, I don't know that that necessarily works. I don't know that that necessarily connects with a younger audience. I think we've got to find ways that video can be made to relate to people more, to provide information to them that can be quickly digested, a little bit on the entertaining side. I mean, I think a compelling news event like the Parliament shootings, obviously that's gonna you know, really drive people's imagination. But I think that for us, trying to figure out what's the best way to create video content around the new iPhone. Okay, that was a big challenge for us.
Yeah, everybody's doing it.
Right. This was a huge, huge moment for our audience. We love Apple product launches, I got to tell you. Our audience...
Still?
Yes. I mean, let's just say traffic is really nice on those days. But it just goes to show, you know, what that moment means to our audience, what a new iPhone means. But that was a very interesting challenge. Very proud of the work that we did, but it did require. It wasn't a piece of news video because you kind of know the news. You know,
right.
We got a new phone. So how are you going to make that relatable to the audience? The best idea that we had, and I still love this video. It's on our site. If you can find it, it's really worth looking at. From the keynote address to the actual on sale date of the iPhone, the only thing that we really knew were specs, right? And among those specs were the physical size of the phone. So one of my editors had the idea, okay, why don't we 3D print a phone? It's not a real phone, obviously, it's a piece of blue plastic, but it's in the exact shape and size of the iPhone 6. And we gave it to a bunch of staff members and said, you know, try to shove this in your pants pocket. And we had a video camera and we put them in the studio. Again, it's great 80 to 90 seconds worth of video entertainment, but it's just really cool. Young people looking at this thing, trying to put it in their pocket, sort of evaluating it by its size. It was very entertaining and very relatable, and I think it captured some of the some of the interest and enthusiasm about that event. That to me is the challenge, finding subjects like that and then interpreting them and delivering them in a way that the audience is going to want to consume.
Yeah, and as you say, a lot of that goes back to having the idea or having the team together with the time to come up with an idea like mm-hmm. that, which is a little bit different. I think actually if you kept going in one of your slides, there was something you'd done with a House of Congress or Parliament or something,
yes.
Which was made with Lego.
Yeah, okay.
That one.
Yeah, let me get to Lego Senate.
Senate?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned this. All right, Lego Senate. So, again, I have a team of very creative young people, and I love it when they get in a room and try to figure out, okay, what are we going to do? That's the question. So in this case, it was, what are we going to do election night? Again, we have a small staff. We don't have, I think the New York Times probably has almost as many interactive graphics people on their staff as I have in my entire editorial operation. Maybe an exaggeration, but not by much. Somebody said, maybe as a joke, why don't we try to represent what happened with the midterm elections through Legos? And sure enough, that became the plan. One of our editors spent the better part of an afternoon trying to figure out how to recreate the floor plan of the Senate. I actually thought he was going too far and trying to make it too accurate. I said, just let's keep it simple. But we did this, and every time a state was called, we moved one of the Lego pieces around, and essentially, we had it set up in our studio, took a photograph of it, published it on our site. And then at the end of the night, we put them all together in a GIF and published that on the site.
Yeah.
It was great information, and I think the our audience really liked it. I think it was one of the most talked about pieces of journalism that was created by any news organization that night. And certainly there was a big headline to be gained at the end of the night when the Republicans took control of the US Senate. But I think we were able to deliver the information in a whimsical but certainly accurate and accessible and relatable way.
So this is one of the other things I'm interested in terms of how you come up with the idea and the execution to do things like this. I was talking not so many months ago with David Carr, and we were talking about the move to the new New York Times building.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it came at just the right time for them, because he said all of a sudden reporters were sitting next to digital people and video people were not so far off. And I think the way he put it was, you sit there and all of a sudden you realize, hey, these guys know stuff, Which shouldn't be an epiphany, but I think for some reporters, it can be.
I think
be.
It is, yeah.
What have you learned now in your time at Mashable that you would take back to a newsroom somewhere else, a newsroom that was set up, a lot longer ago, about how to create an environment where this kind of collaboration can happen and where digital and print can coexist and so on?
Well, David is right. I think that a lot has changed at the Times. And I saw some of this happen myself, where the right people were being brought together to cross-pollinate ideas. I still think, though, that the Times and a lot of news organizations still haven't quite grasped either, the digital-first philosophy or really more importantly now, the mobile-first philosophy. I think that if there was anything that my staff could help them with was, because we don't have to worry about print. And I understand, obviously, why the Times, the Globe and Mail, why those news organizations have those kinds of pressures. It is somewhat of a luxury that we have that others don't. But truly thinking about, okay, if we didn't have to worry about print, what would we be doing? What would be, start with the device that more people are going to be accessing your information on. Start thinking there. And I think that's still a significant challenge the print media have. Mentioning BuzzFeed, I was actually thinking I went to a panel recently and learned that within their CMS, they actually have mobile versions of their articles so that editors can actually see how their stories are going to appear on mobile before they're published.
Interesting.
And in fact, I think the way it's, if I'm not mistaken, they should, I should allow them to speak for themselves, but if I understood it correctly, basically, an editor cannot publish a story until he or she scrolls all the way, through the mobile presentation. Mm. And so, forcing that kind of thinking on a traditional newsroom probably would be the most important thing that I could try to bring.
That's really interesting. I want to get to two more things in the time I have left, at least. But I just want to remind everybody before I do, we're going to have ample time for questions from the audience, where I hope you will fill in the gaping holes in the questions I have asked. So do keep that in mind and be ready to come to the mic not too long from now. I'd be remiss if I let you leave here without asking you one thing. When you read a Mashable story, one of the things that jumps out at you is the big green number right there near the byline and the headline, which tells you how many shares it's already had. Mm-hmm. Shares, share is one of the big words on a Mashable story. What makes something shareable? Strip it down for us.
Sharing is a really interesting phenomenon, I think. And it's probably worth a minute or two to understand why you would want to share. Forget about content. What would you want to tell your friends at a dinner party? What would you want to tell your parents or your spouse? I think it's a pretty powerful motivator. The desire for one person or another to enlighten, entertain, inform someone about a subject. And so I think it's healthy to think, to try to put yourself in that position. What is it that you think others will be interested in? I mean, one of the simplest ways that I'm now kind of exercising my news judgment at Mashable is if I see something on another site or, in my Twitter feed or, on the wires, and I think, well, I'd like to share that story, then to me that means I want to publish that story, or I want to somehow make sure that my audience on my publication, is aware of that event.
Yeah.
Or that phenomenon or that thought or that video. So I think that one of the healthiest ways that I can do it, my reporters, my content creators, my, you know, the people I work with, is to think, okay, is this a subject that you would want, you know, again, to tell your family about, to tell your parents or your coworkers or people at the bar about? It's just a very interesting exercise. I think that the motivating factor of wanting to, you know, enlighten, entertain, I mean, that's why animal pictures are so popular, because the people who share them know that it will probably bring a smile or a warm, cuddly feeling to the person that they're sharing it to. Sharing is very important to us. It's central to our business model. I mean, we recognize that the vast majority of people access Mashable content not by direct navigation. Yep. Some of them come through search, but a lot of them are coming through Facebook, Twitter, and other means like that. I guess your question was, what exactly makes a story that makes a story shareable? I in no particular order. Something that does make you smile, I think, is inherently shareable. Something that can shock you is shareable. I think news can be shareable, even hard and incredibly grim news. The Ebola photo package that I mentioned was very shareable. I'll give you an anecdote of something that actually wasn't very shareable, and this one I thought is very interesting too. I mean, so let's go back a month, month and a half, when the photos, the Jennifer Lawrence photos were published. That story that we produced, and I'm sure our news site I'm sure we're no different from many others. That single story that we published after that was a very, very highly trafficked article, but not shared very often. I mean, the disparity was really striking. You know, the traffic was up here and the share count was down here. And I mean, that's kind of obvious. You feel a little icky about it. You know, you can kind of click an anonymity maybe. And I'm sure that a lot of our traffic was propelled, you know, by search, you know, Jennifer Lawrence nude. But it wasn't, you know, it didn't appeal to the sharing instincts that that I think people have. So I do, you know, things that make people feel good, honestly, are very often shared, but that's not the only thing.
Yeah. I want to get to this. I could talk to you about sharing all night, but I want to get to this because you've got this enormous and very dedicated audience, I think. But we're seeing a lot of different business models being tried out and changed and reversed. We're seeing a resurgence in paywalls. We just had a major newspaper here in Toronto that decided to abandon its paywall after 14 months. We have seen a lot of new native advertising. We've seen more news organizations doing events to try and generate revenue, et cetera, et cetera. Is Mashable profitable?
Oh, indeed. Mashable has... Mashable's been profitable from the start. We've got a very sound, sensible business model. We've got it is based on the sharing environment, the sharing impulse. It is it's advertising driven. We also do branded content, which is a growing source of revenue for us, I think by and large, advertising branded content, which is a variant of advertising, that's the vast majority of our business. We do some events, but still, that's really what does it. And the sharing drives traffic. The traffic drives ad impressions, and that drives the business.
What do your advertisers want beyond sheer traffic? Or is it mostly traffic that they're asking for? Are they asking for a particular demographic? Are they asking for people to spend a certain amount of time on the page?
You know, I'm probably going to dodge. I would probably leave that to our ad salespeople. I'm not in those conversations enough to know precisely the answer. I don't think traffic alone, though. This is an educated guess, I guess, but I don't think traffic alone is enough. I think that I think advertisers, brands, still want to be identified with brands that that they can respect. They want to identify with brands that can, you know, not only deliver eyeballs, but that can be influential and that people will respect and stick with. And I think this goes back to your earlier question about credibility, that when we think about those 40 million uniques, I'm proud to be able to say that I've delivered those 40 million uniques in a way that is journalistically sound, that's not cheap, and that, you know, is built around a very creative product.
So what's the biggest pressure on you from a business standpoint in terms of staying profitable, as the competition continues to get stiffer, as I'm sure it will, or growing your profitability? What's the biggest pressure on you from that standpoint? And is that felt in the newsroom?
Nope. I basically feel like, you know, my mission is to do several things. It's to create great content, to create engaging content, and to build an audience. And that's what I'm trying to do, and they all fit together. And we use a variety of techniques. I'm not going to lie and pretend that working on viral content doesn't make a huge difference, because it does. It builds, you know, those 40 million uniques, really, you know, a lot goes into that, and some of the viral content is responsible for that kind of traffic and that kind of audience. But by no means is that doing it alone. Yeah. So I feel about as much pressure as any other journalist probably does to deliver an audience and keep them engaged, but I'm not thinking about it every second, and certainly our newsroom doesn't. Now we do. I talk about traffic, and I talk about traffic at least once a week. I meet with my newsroom staff at the end of every week, and we look at top level traffic statistics. We look at, you know, both. Sort of aggregate uniques. We look at the stories that did the best that week. We also look not just at uniques and at, you know, simple, you know, traffic numbers. We also look at time spent, which is, you know, an incredibly valuable valuable metric for us. Mm-hmm. I'm not at all shy about sharing traffic information with the staff. You know, we put those share counts very visibly on the top of every single article. Yeah. And so every journalist at Mashable is aware, sometimes painfully, you know, if their pieces are you know, performing less well. But you know, most people realize that the next piece that they could do could become viral and could have 100,000 shares before the end of the week.
I want to throw it open to the floor now and ask you to ask Jim some questions. So if you want to start, we've got a mic which is on the back of that side. If we could have an orderly lineup, that would be great. I have a little bit of housekeeping to do on that, which is to please use the microphone just so that everybody here and on the live feed and on CPAC when it airs and everything can hear you. If you're comfortable, please tell us your name and affiliation. And I can't stress this enough, please keep your questions brief and in the form of a question. No soliloquies, no matter how Shakespearean they may be.
I want to hear the soliloquies. We're going to differ on this.
Jim? All right. I've been overruled.
Okay, no. Go ahead.
We've got a question here. Thanks. Oh, is the mic on? There. Are you alive now? Do we have a mic? Sorry about this, everybody.
That's all right.
I think we're live.
Take this opportunity.
Should I ask one more?
I just got to do it. I was waiting for the right moment.
I have a beautiful soliloquy I'd like to share. Hi, I'm Lindsay. I'm with Maclean's Magazine. I'm wondering if you could speak earlier, Jim, you mentioned the the vertical that you created, the climate vertical. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what, when you talk about a vertical, what that means for Mashable now, because I think we talk a lot about the death or the diminishing of the homepage. We don't talk a lot about what we would traditionally think of as sort of category pages or what's become more popularly known as a vertical. So when you think about a creating one, are you thinking about the idea of it? Are you thinking about ad sales related to the vertical?
I guess you could do, I can give you two examples, one that is and one that isn't. No, for me, when I first thought of climate, that was really much more of a body of work as opposed to a vertical. I mean, we do have a category page for it. It's in part of the internal navigation, so people can, you know, find it if they want to. I'm one of those people who think that navigation is generally used by journalists a lot more than by the audience. So I don't really know how much value that is. But in that case, it was really, okay, this is a topic, you know, a topic that I want to focus on and a topic that I want us to be identified with. And so that was the way that was described. We've been doing we do travel coverage, for instance. And I think that's a little bit more of a classic vertical in the sense that, we think of it as something that a brand could potentially sponsor, that kind of thing. So look at it both ways. But I think that for me, this may be the difference between me and say our chief strategy officer or maybe the chief revenue officer, that they may be thinking of verticals as more sales monetization potential, while I'm thinking of them a little bit more in the realm of, is this a topic that we should drill down on and a topic that we should try to deliver more to our audience?
Thanks.
Sure.
I've got a question from Twitter for you here. This comes from one of my bosses, so I better get this right. Where does Mashable see itself in 10 years, 20 years?
God, that's a really good question.
Isn't it?
Thanks, Chris. Okay. We have not had the 10 or 20 year conversation.
Not at all?
No.
5 year conversation?
No. I think we've thought about where we are in 5 years. I don't think we are that vastly different in terms of what our content mix is. I think that we're probably a lot more mobile than we are now. I think that if anything, what I would be thinking about for 5 years from now is, how are we going to be delivered to the audience? What will we look like on a smartwatch or some other wearable device? And how will video or whatever, video components, how they will be integrated into our report. I think that the mix of content and the way we look at our subjects feels like it is working. I think it is something that, as I said earlier, I want to continue to grow and expand. Just so that this is my theory about what our readers want and what I'm trying to do content-wise. We started as a technology blog, we're devoted to technology, social media. And what I've tried to do is build subjects around that, things that I really feel can connect to that core. When I thought about climate, that it wasn't directly related to technology, but the sort of science aspects that seem to, make at the heart of both felt like they resonated well together. And so a lot of the subjects that I'm interested in do sort of float around that core of technology.
Okay. That was from Chris Wilson-Smith, the deputy national editor at The Globe, just so you know.
All right, good question.
Another question here.
Hi, Robert Cosey with Glacier Media. Can you talk a little bit about how you market Mashable, your Mashable? How you extend your reach, what your relationship is with Facebook and Twitter and those kinds of opportunities that you might use?
Yeah, well, this goes back to sharing and how important sharing is for our audience growth and business model. I mean, you know, when you think about it, while we have a conventional website, we have a very traditional taxonomy, the structure is very traditional. Our means of distribution is much more than just a website. We look to our audience. Our audience as our distributors. And so Facebook is very important to that. Twitter is very important, although I think, you know, if you look at the numbers, the traffic that we get through Facebook is vastly higher than what we get through Twitter. So I guess I would answer what your question in saying is that Facebook and Twitter, yes, they are marketing, but to me they're more important as channels for distribution, if that makes sense. That they really are at the heart of how we expect our material to get to people. Yeah, go ahead. Keep going.
I guess the question is, do you put money into Facebook? Do you put money into a marketing program, and where does that money go?
Well, yeah, we do put money into Facebook. I couldn't really tell you, exactly how or how much. That's not really part of my remit. But yes, we do, we do paid efforts in Facebook.
Hi, my name is Tim. I'm from a local site here called blogto.com. And my question sort of dovetails with that one. You talked a lot about your team. Oh, I'm not close enough.
Yeah, there you go.
You talked a lot about your team, unless I missed it, I didn't hear you talk about your social media team. And I was wondering if you could give us all a bit more information in terms of, do you have a social media team? Is it some of the same people that are part of your editorial team?
Yeah.
And sort of a second part to that question, related to Facebook, I sort of looking at your just on the mobile Facebook page, and you guys have 2.9 million fans or something like that, like over 2 million fans, correct?
Yeah.
And I'm just looking at some of the numbers on your posts, and some of them are like 23 likes, 28 likes, some higher ones in the hundreds, and maybe a few in the low thousands. How do those numbers add up? Like, how do you get those massive social shares, and how do you account for sort of like the numbers of your fans versus the kind of like counts that you're seeing on Facebook? Can you give any more details on that?
I wish I could, but I think I can address your first question a little bit more easily than the second. You shouldn't drift too far from the mic, though, because you may want to follow up. But so this might be more detail than you want. We sort of split up the social media responsibilities. Generally, the way it works at Mashable, and I think every news organization probably would approach it slightly differently, basically Twitter is the responsibility of the newsroom. And so basically our news desk, our live news editor, our real-time news editors are responsible for all of our Twitter feeds. The individual desks manage their own. Facebook is managed more, and Pinterest as well, is managed by a separate desk. I think that has a lot to do with the fact that I think Facebook is a bigger puzzle. Whether it's the changes in the algorithm or the difficulty that many news organizations have sort of penetrating how Facebook actually works, I think we've found it helpful to have essentially specialists who are working in that field. They would be the people to answer your second question better about the relationship between likes and fans. I'm really not the best person to be able to, to sort of help you make those numbers, add up better. I do know, though, that generally Facebook traffic Facebook is responsible for, depending on the day, anywhere between 25 and 35% of our traffic. So something's working there.
Thanks. If I may, since I guess Twitter's within the news realm, if I understood correctly, Facebook is maybe you're not as close to.
Not directly.
Are there any best practices you can share with us in terms of how you guys use Twitter in the newsroom, in terms of posting frequency, length of cop, like any kind of best practices that you
right,
have?
Right, right. The single best practice is not have your tweets read like headlines. And of course, we're trying to write headlines that sound less like headlines too. But I think that, you know, much of what I see on Twitter is, you know, a headline of sorts, which I find generally uninviting and very repetitive for what I see, you know, on any number of news sites. So I like to, you know, I know when I tweet and when others tweet, finding nuggets of news that are kind of, you know, buried in a piece that might not be the, you know, the main news headline. You know, when it's appropriate, attaching a photo to the tweet. I rue saying this a bit because I do see the tendency to, you know, for many people to attach a photo to every single tweet so that, you know, whatever stream you have, it, you know, becomes basically this undifferentiated, you know, mass of little thumbnail pictures. But it does work. People do pay more attention to those photos than they do the words. But we don't really worry too much about frequency. I think, you know, there will, at some point you reach a limit, but we don't get much in the way of blowback from it. Facebook, on the other hand, we are very careful about not doing too much. I think we're also aware that Facebook kind of tends to penalize you in some ways if you overdo it. But I think in terms of the frequency, that's not, you know, not a giant worry. We've also created a couple of accounts that really are very focused on, you know, breaking news or developing news. So those I even worry about less when it comes to frequency. In fact, I feel like if people subscribe to that, they know that when a news event is happening, when things are breaking, that we're going to be flooding them with information.
Next up.
Hi, I'm Craig Sellers with the Globe and Mail. I'm curious, who is Mashable's audience, and who do you see it growing into being, and how does that differ from sort of a more localized audience that you're dealing with, say, at Reuters or New York Times?
I think the biggest differentiator is age. I think that our, you know, audience is much younger than that of the New York Times. I think technology, you know, has been the core, or technology coverage has been the core of our publication from the beginning. And I think that still is a unifier. It's not the single biggest thing, but it is something with which a lot of people can identify with. I mean, we're not we're not TechCrunch, we're not Engadget. I think we look at technology a little bit more maybe from the consumer point of view. And so I sort of define our audiences as younger people whose lives really revolve around their devices. They revolve around digital information and entertainment. You know, our marketing people have often used the phrase, the voice of digital culture, as kind of a tagline for us. And that actually does have a good ring to it, because I think that we do appeal to people whose lives really do, you know, who really identify with the technology, the software, the entertainment that powers it.
We're going to get to everyone at the mic. I just want to ask, just because I think this is a helpful and quick question from
Sure.
Twitter, and maybe we can just answer it really succinctly. This is from Carrie K. Taylor. She said, I'd love, Jim, to define viral content. Is it page views, visits, time frame, shares? When you say something's viral, has reached viral, what
Yeah.
do you mean?
Well, we measure, I think there's a great pertinence to the fact that we issue, or I mean, we list share counts on our articles. That is what being viral is about. That is, you know, it's passing on information to another person, and that person passing it on to five other people, and it, you know, it's spreading truly like a virus. So I think that share count is, of all of the things that that was mentioned in the question, I think share count is the most important single distinguisher.
Thanks for the question, Carrie. Matthew.
That fits right into my question. Share count is hugely important. You talked about, you know, it's right at the top of the story. Everyone looks at it. Presumably writers look at it. Do you use those share counts in any way, either in terms of compensation? Do you look at them when you're talking to reporters? What are their consequences if the share count isn't high enough over a period?
Yeah.
Good question.
Great question. We do not tie compensation to share count or traffic or anything like that. And, you know, it's funny. I was telling somebody earlier, I had a conversation with a rather new employee a couple of weeks ago. He had started, written a handful of things, and they were like, you know, sitting at about 1,000 or less, you know. And this, again, is shares, not page views or anything like that. And he was sort of saying, you know, without sounding too depressed, he said, you know, what is good? What are we looking for? You know, no. And I knew exactly where he was coming from because I knew where his stories were. And I said, you know, it's inevitable that you're going to look at it, but I'm here to tell you that it doesn't matter. Now, of course it does, but I really wanted to tell him that it really didn't matter.
But if it doesn't matter, why is it at the
top?
But
wait a second. But what I said was, don't worry about it. It'll drive you crazy because there are things that happen that are just, you know, you just can't comprehend. There are certain mechanisms that can take content viral that you can sort of understand when you unpack it, but it still boggles the mind. So this same person, I'll probably wind up giving away his identity, and I don't want to do this. Like within 2 or 3 days, he writes a story, and it truly it crossed the 100,000 share threshold after a couple of days of publication, and that is more than viral. That's like mega viral for us. And so here I was preaching to him, don't worry about it, don't even look at it. You know, and then 2 or 3 days later, you know, it just goes off the charts. So it is important because it's important to the business model. But I think there are so many variables that go into it. I know that the people that we hire are going to hit, they are going to have those moments. You know, it's up to us to, you know, try to steer our staff to try to, you know, make the right choices, and it's not always going to be to choose to do content that will be viral. But I think we sort of view the broad, you know, the panoply of content that we produce, that some of those things will go viral and they will help build the business.
Thanks.
Should we have the next person at the mic? Thank you.
Hi, Salim. Salim Khan, InvestigateNet. I want to come back to the question of the future. You said that Mashable is profitable, and I've had conversations with some of your former colleagues looking at sort of the landscape of news in the United States and how some of the serious coverage, the State House coverage, the things that aren't sort of flashy and sexy, that's waning or is at risk. And just over the weekend, the Global Investigative Journalism Network has been doing some education work and had some interviews about the threat to investigative journalism, lack of funding, and so on. And I'm curious to know, you said that you want to do other types of serious, hard news and journalism. Do you see that potentially on your roadmap, filling in some of these gaps, particularly because you do work at a profitable organization?
I think that the answer is yes within some limits. I mentioned Ukraine a while ago. Granted, that's not exactly an investigative reporting effort, but you know, that was a subject we did invest in early on, and as I said, I wound up hiring the reporter who had done a lot of that work. We've done reporting from Liberia. We've done reporting from Iraq. around ISIS. I would like to get to the point where we can invest in some deeper investigative coverage. And I actually think that that time, you know, will come to us. I mean, one of the things that we were talking about before we began, before we came up here, because we feel comfortable doing this array of content, some of it quite whimsical, because we feel like, you know, we can do things that do get shared 100,000 times and produce a lot of, quite a few page views and thus, you know, revenue for us, that we can use that as a way to pay for more ambitious content that, you know, that might not achieve the quite viral levels of 100,000 shares. So I don't know that we can, you know, truly be the substitute for some of the, you know, some of the crunches that other news organizations do face, but I do believe that that we can invest in that kind of responsible coverage, and that we will invest in that kind of responsible coverage, and that we can, you know, help fund it through a lot of these other techniques and using more viral content.
Thank you. We have got a lineup back here. I have to be harsh and crack the whip because we're hitting 8 o'clock and the cameras need to stop rolling. We are going to have mingling and cocktails shortly, so if you're at the back and you have a question, Jim will be there. So keep it in mind, please.
It's wonderful to see so many questions. You'll get a chance to chat with Jim at the cocktail, and you'll also get a chance to check out these cowboy boots that Jim is rocking tonight.
All ready for the wild, wild west of online news.
At the cocktail reception. That brings our CJFJ talk to a close. On behalf of the foundation, I'd like to thank Jim Roberts for joining us and sharing his insights into visual storytelling, connecting with audiences, for sharing Mashable's structure and its news ambitions. And I'd also like to thank the Globe and Mail's James Bradshaw for leading tonight's conversation and for the work he put into making this an interesting and substantive discussion. Please join me in a round of appreciation for our speakers.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our in-kind sponsor, CNW, for promoting the CJFJ Talk series. We are back here on November 27th for a timely discussion about breaking the big stories. Leading investigative journalists Kevin Donovan from the Toronto Star and Diana Swain from CBC News will join us for a J-Talk on the importance of investigative journalism to the future of news. You can check out the CJF website for details on this event. I want to thank all of you for being here tonight and for supporting the work of the CJF. And please stay and join us for more cocktails and conversation at the back of the room. Thank you. Okay.